great tune, and what a nice rendition of it by Ella. I guess we can't listen to the whole thing. I have to say that I'm getting hooked on the 9/11 Commission now. And, I mean, really, it's kind of spellbinding to watch some of this testimony, and it's also kind of an education in how stuff is done or how stuff isn't done. I mean, just sort of a lot of material to digest if you're watching this stuff. But for people who don't know, Richard Clark, the sort of media celebrity of the week, is currently on the stand testifying under oath, and Bruce and I just heard him, among other things, refute the notion that he is auditioning for a job in the Kerry administration. He said, let me take this opportunity to testify while I'm under oath. I will not accept a job in the Kerry administration should one be offered to me, because he just seems to want to get that out of the way. Also pointed out that the last time he had to declare a party affiliation, it was in a Virginia primary a few years ago, and he was a Republican. So wanted to make it clearer. I mean, the thing that's clear to me, actually, is that a lot of the key players in this story and a lot of the players who are causing discomfort for the Bush administration are either nonpartisan or Republicans or people who, I mean, as you know, for example, there's this guy that that he teaches with, that Scott McClellan actually called his best buddy or something like that, who has a job in the Kerry campaign. Well, as Clark pointed out just now from the stand, the guy that McClellan is talking about, like him, served in the Reagan administration, in Bush 1, in Clinton, and then in Bush 2. And this isn't some Democratic operative for Kerry, lifelong, you know, Democratic mole or something. This is a guy who served, you know, two or three Republican presidents. But anyway, I mean, I think Clark is a pretty spellbinding witness, and he, I think the person to watch, this is like my NCAA bracket pick. You know, this is
the pick of the week.
This is the upset.
Here it is. The upset pick of the week.
Number 8 ranked Jamie Gorelick. Now, here's why. First of all, she is facing Mississippi State in the next round, I think, the week. But, she alone on this commission, I don't know if you remember all this, but a long time ago there was this big debate going on about the so-called daily briefs. The daily briefs are these incredibly secure things that Bush gets to look at, and that contain a lot of very significant intelligence information. So could this commission, under any circumstances, look at the daily briefs? No, was the answer. Well, the compromise that was eventually reached, I was not aware of that there was a compromise, but the compromise apparently that was reached was that Jamie Gorelick, alone on the commission, could look at these briefs. And that after the commission had gotten through with its work, they would kill her. No, that's not part of it. That's a...
How ridiculous is this? One person gets to look at the briefs.
One person
can do what with them?
Well, I guess she's allowed to sort of know what's in them, and perhaps
but can't tell anybody.
She can't tell anybody, although she can, and she has.
What good is that?
Well, she can, and she has said significant, a significant thing. And not only that, but I mean that's why I was interested to hear her question, Clark, because her mood, I think, is very much, it's kind of interesting. It's interesting to know how she's feeling about stuff, because she's seen these briefs and nobody else has. And I as she questioned Clark, I thought her overall goal was to prove that on a number of points, Condoleezza Rice is lying. She actually said she wished that Condoleezza Rice was coming before the commission because she wanted to ask these things. Instead, Armitage is coming. She's going to ask him. But at one point, she basically, I think there were two matters on which she said to Clark, you know, citing, I guess, an article that Condi Rice wrote in the Washington Post about all this. You know, is this true? And he'd say no. But most significantly, I think, to me, this is the whole story right here. And you can say that this is partisan spin if you want, but God knows, we just listened to 5 hours of Republican partisan spin. So listen to me for a couple minutes.
5 hours?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what Ray did. I doubt he did. But Ray, actually, I don't see Ray as like this incredibly partisan person. I mean, he has his leanings and these wacko, quasi-libertarian ideas and stuff like that. And then he has his buddies, you know, and he sticks up for them and stuff like that. But I don't see Ray as this incredibly partisan person. And I mean, in some ways, I don't see Buddy as incredibly partisan either. He's just nuts. He's just, you know, absolutely, you know, raving, barking mad. But Rush is incredibly partisan. Well, anyway, what Gorelick says is interesting because, I mean, all you hear basically if you're listening to all this spin is, Well, Clinton screwed up. No, Bush screwed up. Well, no, Clinton screwed up. No, Bush screwed up. Well, maybe they both screwed up. Well, it's sort of true that they both screwed up. But one of the things that Clark insists on, anyway, is that the Clinton administration had a more coherent response to al-Qaeda and to terrorism. It didn't always kick in the right way, and sometimes it didn't kick in the right way because of his own caution. I should say one other thing. That Clark did a remarkable thing that nobody else has done so far. In his opening statement, virtually the only thing he did in his opening statement was to apologize. He apologized to the American people for failing to stop al-Qaeda. He apologized to the families of September 11 victims for failing to stop al-Qaeda. He said, you know, we all failed you. I failed you, and I'm sorry. And, I mean, nobody else has done this. So that was the number one. Well, anyway, here's the one thing that Gorelick is able to say, and I think it's important because it's why Clark is as angry as he is. And it's the thing that ultimately we're all going to have to kind of come to grips with as the difference between the Clinton administration and the Bush administration. She has said that at some point in 2001, you get the feeling it's the summer, you know, maybe starting around the early summer of 2001, these daily briefs contain what she calls an extraordinary spike in intelligence reports warning of an attack by al-Qaeda. And she says that this spike, this extraordinary spike, as she puts it, goes up there and then it just stays there for weeks and weeks and weeks. It's not something like one day they had a report of this and then kind of went away. She's saying that this level of warning, this extraordinary level of warning about intelligence they have about an al-Qaeda strike stays there in those daily briefs for weeks and weeks and weeks, and basically nothing is done. And I think that's the key to all this. I think that's ultimately what this commission is going to wind up saying that will be so devastating to the Bush administration. Now, is it devastating to the Bush administration because they are, you know, blind ideologues who could only see their hatred for Iraq? Is it devastating to the Bush administration because they were missile wackos who just, you know, were really interested in missiles and not too interested in some of the... I don't know. Who knows? It's not important. Maybe none of it's important. But if the truth is important to you, I think that's a key truth. And that's one of the things that this Clark stuff is all about. That starting sometime in the early summer of 2001, there was, despite the fact that a lot of information wasn't getting to the top. I mean, for example, Clark says, and you saw the 60 Minutes thing, and I didn't, I don't know if this comes out. Clark says, well, yeah, these like low-level FBI people knew that al-Qaeda was here in the country. He said, I didn't know that. I was a counterterrorism chief. I didn't know that because the information wasn't getting up. But even given the failures to connect certain dots, the failures to make certain kinds of information available, there was enough of intelligence information available to constitute this extraordinary spike, and then nothing was done. And I think that ultimately is, you know, and the other thing that you should know about Clark, particularly if you've been listening to this station for the last 5 hours, is that the commission's own staff work seems to support Clark's fundamental contention. In other words, this commission just didn't start meeting 2 days ago. This commission has been in session and with a staff that's been compiling information, taking testimony and stuff like that for quite some time. And they're just starting to take public testimony right now. And this commission is already issuing staff reports. And the staff reports are basically saying, maybe not as strongly worded, but they're basically saying what Clark's saying, which is that this administration kind of didn't get it. They didn't get it. They didn't understand how dangerous al-Qaeda was. They weren't particularly, the Rumsfeld and his people just weren't all that focused on that. You'd try to talk to them about it and wanted to talk about missiles or whatever. So, I mean, you know, people can scream about Clark and smear him and say, well, he said this in 2002 and he said this in 1998. And how come he didn't kill Osama bin Laden himself with the Saturday Night Special? I think what's ultimately going to come out here that's going to be damning to the Bush administration, maybe unfairly, you know, I mean, maybe Rumsfeld's right. Maybe just no matter what you knew, you might not have been able to really see what was coming. But whether it's fair or not, what is going to tear at people is when they grasp that fact that sitting right in front of the president's nose was information about how dangerous al-Qaeda was right at that moment, and nobody did anything.
Phone number's here, 522-WTIC, 800-966-WTIC. And from your cell phone, it's Star WTIC. We're Bruce and Colin.
Involved in the radio station sort of, but you know, ESPN, I think on ESPN.com they have a daily poll question where you can vote, and today it's I guess it's Sammy Hagar is going to go back with Van Halen for a while, so the question is Sammy Hagar or David Lee Roth, who is the definitive Van Halen front man?
I don't know.
This is the kind of thing that could, you know, like the boys are in here who produce, like Bobby Sherwood and Mikey C and James and stuff. That's like a 4-hour discussion for them.
At least 4 hours.
That's like, you know, Aquinas and his fellow Scholastics talking about the nature of angels or something. David Lee Roth is the correct answer, by the way.
That's what I was leaning to.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I don't even like Van Halen, but I mean, the correct answer is there is no need really for there to be any more activity by Van Halen of any kind involving anybody. That's the correct answer. But if there has to be Van Halen activity, David Lee Roth. We were happy to take phone calls, by the way. Did you already say that?
Yeah.
All right. You look nice today. You're
right.
A little, you know what? I think we should do this makeover thing, this AIDS makeover thing. You know, this AIDS, the thing I was telling you about.
You might want to rephrase that.
Well, no, okay. It's like it's a fashion makeover to benefit the Connecticut AIDS Residents Coalition.
Yeah.
Oh, really? I haven't really looked at Bobby yet. Does he look good? Does he look good today? I
guess no, he's the same, as always.
I saw him walk by. He doesn't have a hat on, though.
No hat. I had that surgically removed.
I looked nice today until I went to my tax guy. Well, I love my tax guy. By the way, can I have some money? It turns out I have like no money whatsoever.
Yeah, well, we're going to be two of us in that little deal.
I love my tax guy, and I love his dogs, but his dogs are there while you're doing the taxes, which is fine. Except the minute I walked in, I had to put on a nice white shirt today, so I look nice for you.
Yeah, you do.
And the dog came over and just put his money.
What kind of dog is it?
Two golden retrievers, and they're lovely.
All right, they're beautiful. I love gold.
But they're morons. So anyway, so I look nice, but I have a big muddy stain. The reason I'm dressed nice also
is the muddy stain?
Right here. Okay.
Oh, yes, I do see that. Very nice.
And then I just cleaned it with a pen, and I think I made a pen mark, too. So I'm going to speak at the Connecticut Library, the Canton Library tonight.
Like that?
Like, well, I'll put a jacket on.
Oh.
I have a jacket, so nobody will see it. But those of you who do attend... Yeah, no, it won't do any good. Those of you who do attend the Canton Library speech tonight, I will have a stain.
Yeah, throw some dog biscuits on stage.
Yeah. You'll not be able to see my stain. Should we talk to Cheryl?
Oh, I think so. Cheryl, hi.
Hi, Colin.
What do you
Hi, Bruce.
Hi.
I have a comment about President Bush and this Richard Clark deal.
Okay.
And I'm not sure it makes any sense at all, but it seems to me that, I mean, he's the president, for God's sake. Even if he was going hell-bent after Iraq in... Saddam Hussein, why not just come out and say that? You would think he could be accountable to the decisions that he makes as the president. And so what if it meant that he got sidetracked from Afghanistan and the search for Osama bin Laden in the process? You know, just come out and say, all right, this is what I did. But to resort to putting down Richard Clark and attacking him in a very personal way, as he's attempted to do, I think is just... disgusting.
I mean, realistically speaking, I don't think you're going to see President Bush, like, you know, pointing to the smoking ruins of the World Trade Center and say, see that? I got a little distracted by Iraq, and for that happened, I'm really sorry. You know, it's sort of not psychologically anywhere in his makeup to do that, first of all. And second of all, politically, it would be, you might as well just, you know, go back down to Crawford and get that Bush hog out and, you know, start living on his retirement, because he's not going to get a second term if he says anything
like
that.
Yeah, I know, but I don't see that it played out that way. And I think, you know, he made decisions based on whatever information he had after September 11th. And given that information, decided to move forward in a way, regardless of whether it makes sense to the rest of us or not.
Well, one thing I recommend that you read, just because you'll find it interesting, is Will Fallon's piece that's in Slate right now called Fatal Indifference. And basically what he says is that one of the problems was the Bush administration and Bush himself were so contemptuous of Clinton and so distrustful of anything Clinton had ever done that they threw out the good with the bad. They couldn't stand anything that Clinton had ever done. So anything that Clark said that had its roots back in the Clinton years, they completely dismissed the way they dismissed everything else. And that may have gotten them in some trouble, too.
Yeah. Well, it's really interesting to watch this all play out. I mean, I think that a lot of us were sitting there watching Bush saying, you know, that's exactly what he was doing, was going after Saddam Hussein and was looking for any excuse, at least where I sit, to go into Iraq. And here we are.
Well, in fairness, the testimony now makes it clear that he was very interested in doing something about Al-Qaeda. But I think what's interesting was that he was not really willing to consider any kind of nuanced approach to dealing with Al-Qaeda. You know, there's this famous swatting flies quote that you've seen the most. I'm tired of swatting flies. Well, actually, terrorists are flies.
Yeah.
There almost isn't a way to fight terrorists without swatting flies. And that's, in fact, how they beat them back from the Los Angeles airport, you know, a few years before that, by swatting flies, treating it exactly as that kind of operation. There isn't a way to beat terrorism. You know, there isn't sort of a Gulf War-style attack on terrorism that you can do.
Right. Well, I appreciate the insight that you're providing through your show, and I will continue to listen.
Nobody's paying any freaking attention to what we're saying.
Well, I am. Have a good day.
You already thought all that stuff anyway.
Here's quickly Alex in Huntington. Alex.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
You know how I believe the Bush administration doesn't quite have the veracity that's needed for...
Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-baby, time to hit the road to dreamland, you're my baby, dig you in the land of
we'll take your phone calls if you want to talk more about these hearings. By the way, the commission hearings, unfortunately, they're not on television or radio, so you can't watch them. No, I'm kidding. You can. But please don't, all right? Listen to our show instead. We'll tell you whatever you need to know.
Yeah.
But they are pretty riveting, and at least I find them, so. And we can talk more about this. Also, there's obviously some stuff involving Governor Rowland. Watch in terms of the next shoe to drop. And this is something that's been written about in a number of places. Dan Levine's written about it in the Hartford Advocate. There's a piece buried in the Hartford Current today about it by, I think, Altamari. Watch the Naugatuck Valley Development Corporation. That just turns out to be another pot that they were all relieving themselves into. And there's some Tomaso involvement, some ONG involvement. The feds have, in fact, subpoenaed documents having to do with this. A thing mentioned, I think, by Dan Levine in the Hartford Advocate, but maybe not too many other places, is the fact that this guy Mengachi, whose judgeship is currently stalled up there at the state capitol, his law firm did work for the Naugatuck Valley Development Corporation. So, I mean, if I were the people sort of wondering about this guy's judgeship, I'd be wondering, what are we going to find out about this, given the way... I mean, I'm not suggesting, by the way, his law firm did anything wrong or anything like that, but if the Naugatuck Valley Development Corporation, you know, if records relating to that, I mean, just think about this for a second, all right? The feds are subpoenaing from the Rowland administration their records having to do with state dealings with the Naugatuck Valley Development Corporation because, in fact, the development agency gave out more than $100 million in contracts to ONG Industries of Torrington and the Tomaso Group. Now, then think about the fact that their records are being subpoenaed. Let's see. Subpoena issued to the governor's office this week calls for all documents and records relating to several projects involving the Naugatuck Valley Development Corporation. So there's the state involvement with this NVDC. Now, the... Some of the legal work done for NVDC was done by the law firm of this guy Mengachi. Mengachi's wife, Kathleen, is the secretary to Governor Rowland. And Mengachi was a friend of Governor Rowland. They went skiing together. You know, I mean, I don't know.
There's got to be an opportunity here for, a connect the dots coloring book kind of thing. Well, it could be put together with this. I really think that we should put something like that together and market it.
Well, one dot that disconnects to, you would need a really, really big piece of paper, by the way, to get all these dots.
Well, I understand. It'd be an oversized book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One dot that disconnects to a name that we haven't mentioned for a while is Phil Giordano, because, in fact, as the article by Dave Altamari mentions, the authorities are very familiar with some of these Waterbury projects in which the NVDC has been involved, because they were part of a previous investigation involving Waterbury City Hall. That's what they were looking at. That's part of what, remember, the feds were looking at Giordano,
right. Yep.
Not as a sex offender. They were looking at him because of possible corruption and steering contracts and stuff like that. And I guess the probe involved some of these projects that involved NVDC stuff. So it just, you know, it's just one of those places where, you know, once again, a lot of the same names are just turned up all over again. That's all I'm telling you.
Mm.
All right, we've got calls here, and our numbers are 522-WTIC, 1-800-966-WTIC, *WTIC. And I do think, although you look very nice today, and I like the shirt and tie combination, all that kind of stuff, I think we need to do this makeover thing together. I think it would be good for us as a couple to do this.
Yeah.
Because it's going to be, I find out who the other people are. Jim Shea is going to be made over.
Yep.
Eddie Perez is going to be made over.
Okay.
And then the third makeover unit would be you and me as a unit. We'd be made over as a unit.
When is this again?
May 6th.
In the evening?
In the evening at the Pond House. It's a Thursday night. We'd go there right after the show.
Right.
We would work beforehand with a local clothier. So we would have outfits to wear that night.
Uh-huh.
And then hairstylists and people like that would look at our hair and perhaps our other aspects of our grooming.
Right.
I think this could be wonderful for us. Very exciting. And we certainly don't want Jim Shea looking better than we look.
No.
Think about it on that basis.
Right.
You want Jim Shea to be more metrosexual than you? I don't think so. Look at that. We can get on the air with this right away, where Shea would actually, you know, take him a day or two to write the columns.
Right.
So, you know, we'd beat him to the punch.
Instantaneous.
Yep.
Debbie in a car. Hello, Debbie. What would you like to do? Jump off the top of this building, number one. No, I'd actually think I'd like to slide into the call screener seat. Because apparently the call screening action today is quite good.
Bobby's having a tough day. I was over there actually using the faster computer to pull up some information. It doesn't feel like he's having a very nice day.
You get angry after a while listening to some of this foolishness. I mean, really.
Well, in any case, I mean, just sort of in response to, you know, what the guy before was saying, I do think that this is an untruthful administration. I mean, probably the most famous lie that they said was in the State of the Union address last year, when, in fact, President Bush said that Saddam Hussein had recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa. That information was based almost entirely on documents that both the CIA and the White House knew were false. You know, I mean, that's a pretty big one when you're trying to get our nation to go to war, when you're
particularly knowing the fear that people have about nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
Anybody who lived through that Cold War period, you know, especially when you were diving under your desk and doing drills and that kind of stuff, you know, back in the 50s and 60s.
When we were debating stem cells, he talked about how there were plenty of existing stem cells lines to work on. I believe he said there were 60. There was nothing close. There might be 10. When he was pushing his tax cut, he said the jobs and growth plan would reduce tax rates for everyone who pays income tax. The Urban Institute, Brookings Institution Tax Policy Center, found 8.1 million people who pay taxes but would receive no tax cuts. I mean, I can go on and on. And there are a lot of people, actually, if you get really interested in this, David Korn has a website called bushlies.com based on his intense study of lies coming from.
What about the nation building thing? This is even before he was elected.
Yeah, well, I mean,
it was against nation building, and what are we doing now?
You know, you can at least sort of say, well, a lot of people say things in campaigns that they can't back up, you know, that, you know, they get in office and things are different. I think you can sort of let somebody off the hook for something. It's like Weicker, you know, Weicker saying, you know, an income tax would be like dumping kerosene on a fire. Well, then he got in and the numbers were just a lot worse than he'd ever dreamed, and it was the only way out. I mean, you know, yeah, I do think that a lot of the way that President Bush represented himself during his campaign, that he was a uniter, not a divider, that he was a centrist,
that, you know, yeah, as you said, that he wasn't in favor of nation building. I mean, a lot of this stuff just turned out, has not really panned out. But, you know, people say all kinds of things when they're trying to get elected. I'm inclined to cut people a certain amount of slack about that. But, and you know, the Clintons drove me nuts. There's a lot of stuff that they said while they were in office that I just, you know, I didn't think it really bore out very well. But, and I thought, you know, that they were appalling in that way. I mean, there are a number of initiatives that they undertook, which I thought were based on false premises. But, I mean, nothing like this. This has been really significant. And then if you layer on top of the things that are outright lies, the incredible attempt by this administration to withhold information from the public, to make things secret that formerly were not secret, to basically roll back as many of the post-Watergate open government reforms as they possibly can. You know, there really is kind of this war on facts and information. I mean, there may be a war on terrorism, but there's also sort of a war on facts and information. And I find that war, you know, a fairly scary one.
All right. Shall we take some more calls?
Oh, why not?
He said reluctantly.
Yeah. How about that basketball tournament? I think you're going pretty well.
I think you're going pretty well, yeah.
I don't know what happened to Auburn last night.
I don't know. Boy, the second half there, a UConn run. Incredible. Yeah. All right.
I guess there's no hope, huh? We have to talk about this.
Tony in Bristol. Tony.
Oh, hi. How are you, Bruce?
Good. Well, we're back.
I'm looking at the Hartford Advocate, and there's an ad for a restaurant. I won't say which restaurant it is, but they have a murder mystery dinner show.
Yeah.
And so you go there and you have your choice of pork Normandy or fresh baked sole or chicken parmesan and stuff like that. But the name of the murder mystery that you would be participating in is called I See Dead People. It just seems like not the appetizing, you know.
Yeah, I think that would cut down.
Let's go out to dinner. Let's go over to that I See Dead People and have a nice dinner and solve the mystery.
Yeah, relax.
All right.
Marilyn in Waterbury. Hello, Marilyn.
Fire burning, but don't be alarmed. It's just country boys and girls getting down the bar.
Oh, now we're talking. You know, last night on American Idol, it was country night. Everybody had to sing a country song.
Really?
Even the funky people.
Sorry, I missed that.
There's this one poor guy who, he's this young guy, he's from upstate New York. He's 16 years old, and basically what he wants to be is Sinatra. And he does have kind of like a Harry Connick Jr. thing going on. He's this kind of red-haired, you know, kind of sweet-looking kid. He's 16 years old. And basically he grew up listening to standards. But the problem is, that every week they have a themed American Idol thing. Like last week it was Soul Night. Well, this guy doesn't really know any soul songs, nor is his delivery particularly appropriate for most soul songs. So, you know, I mean, so he had to like find, I mean, fortunately, Stevie Wonder is significantly influenced by the American popular song canon. Stevie Wonder is sufficiently influenced by, say, Rodgers and Hart, so that there are any number of Stevie Wonder songs which you could cover and do it kind of in a Sinatra-esque way.
Yeah.
He did that one, I'm a man of many wishes, hope my premonition misses. That one. Anyways, he sounded okay doing that. Last night, he did King of the Road. Because, once again, Roger Miller stuff is pretty easily transferred into that idiom.
Oh, country now. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, last night was country.
Soul? Yeah. King of the Road?
No, for Soul he did Stevie Wonder. For last night he did Roger Miller.
Okay. Shall we get back to this?
I'm giving you one of my periodic American Idol reports.
I'm really glad.
So, and also, before we get back to this, so we are definitely doing the Queer Eye kind of makeover thing, right?
I didn't say we're definitely going
to
do that.
Well, the people, they need to know the people planning this event. They're very, very excited. I think it is fair to say they're very excited by the idea of the two of us together undergoing a couple makeover kind of thing. You know, the two of us would be made over. We would get, you know, we would see a new style of dress for both of us, but one that would complement, so we would look nice together, too, you know?
I see.
And that kind of thing.
Right.
Well, why aren't you more enthusiastic about that? Don't you want us to look nice together?
Well, no. See, I tried to explain yesterday, I'm in the midst of losing this weight.
Right, and you look great. And
well,
you have, like,
I look
another,
great. I look,
you
look better. Great. But
you look hot, all right?
No.
And you would have, like, more than another, what is it now? It's still March, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, so you'd have all of April to lose yet more weight.
Right.
And you would look, you know,
hot. Just how much weight do you think I'm going to lose in a month?
Well, enough so that we could do this, you know. You'll look terrific. And this will give you sort of an even more of an incentive to lose even more weight.
Well,
you'll know how.
Believe me, I have the incentive.
Yeah. You'll know how hot you could really look.
Yeah.
I think we should do it. I think it's a wonderful thing. We'd be helping out a great charity.
Yeah, let me just check.
Make sure your calendar is clear. And then,
well, that's just it. I don't know yet.
Once your calendar is clear, boom, we're doing it.
Why don't you take Sherwood with you?
Well,
that would be good. All right, let me see if I can.
They're very excited. They're very excited about you.
Yes,
you,
I'm sure they are.
The big dog. That's what they said. They said, is it true? Is the big dog coming?
Yeah.
I said, first of all, if you want to talk to the big dog, you have to talk through me, all right? The big dog cannot talk to you.
Right.
But I can talk to the big dog for you. And so let me handle the big dog, all
right?
Right. And then I'll get back to you about what the big dog says.
Okay.
So that's what I'm doing. And what I'm saying
sounds like a great idea.
I'm saying is that the big dog is showing some very positive signs about this.
Sounds like a great idea. Right. So we go pick out clothes? Is that the deal?
We would go probably to a store called Cousy's, C-U-Z-Z-I, and they would help us pick out clothes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. All right. Shall we go to the calls here again?
Yeah, maybe.
maybe.
Let's talk to Leroy.
Leroy, hey.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling.
Why are we wasting so much time? And I'm talking about...
Space was the object of all my country's desire. And it's got...
This is our friend Hugh Blumenfeld. He's going to come in here at some point in the next couple of weeks. He's a med student now.
Is he really?
He became a medical student, yeah.
Good for him.
But he's also going to be doing a gig pretty soon, so we're going to have him come in and promote that.
Have him take our blood pressure and stuff when he's here, too.
Yeah. Do a few tests. So it's looking more and more like you're going to do this makeover thing, right? Because Mrs. Stevens is behind it.
Yeah, apparently, yeah.
Yeah, she's in favor of it.
Yeah.
She heard of that, so that's good. Because... you know, I mean, because you're starting to look pretty hot, but, I mean, you could look even hotter as a result.
No, it's not looking hot.
Well, you did. You're looking hot.
If ever.
You look hot. So, anyway, we're going to do this. It'll be really fun.
You just like seeing me squirm.
I'm going to be in the same position.
Yeah, but you're not in the same position. You've already been through this.
I've done things like this. I'm a little bit of a metrosexual. I'm a little bit more metrosexual than you are.
Yeah, like a lot. Like, yes. Yeah.
I was just saying that to the guy who does my nails the other day. That's a joke, aren't it? But no, it'll be fun. We'll have a great time.
All right.
It's going to be the most fun. Well, I want to mention tonight, by the way, I'm in the Canton Public Library. I'll be there 7:30.
With dog tracks.
To talk about myself.
Can I see that again?
Canton Public Library. See what?
The big dog stain.
Oh, yeah, like dog stain on my... I put on this really nice white shirt today, and I went to go do my taxes. And my... tax guy's dog, like, just the minute I got there, this white shirt hadn't been on my back for more than half an hour. The minute I got there, the dog put his paw on.
He's a golden. He loves people.
Yeah, he's a great dog. He's a very nice dog, you know, but I mean,
they want your affection.
Yeah. But I'll be wearing a...
Apparently, you weren't dishing it out.
No, I was petting the dog, but I'll be wearing my sport jacket, so you won't be able to see it.
Yeah.
There'll be no disturbing stains, at least not in that area.
All right, here's Rick in West Hartford. Rick.
Hey, Bruce and Colin, how are you doing today?
Fine. Good.
This is going to be sort of a drive-by called, but I just wanted to let you know, regarding that previous woman who was questioning what the Bush administration did or did not know, back in July 26th of 2001, CBSNews.com had an article questioning why John Ashcroft had suddenly stopped taking any public commercial flights at all, and was instead opting for a $1,600 per hour Gulfstream to ferry him around the nation. And his explanation was, well, there have been some new security concerns that we're looking into. I don't know anything about it. I'm not going to ask anything about it, but that's the situation so far. So the Bush administration apparently knew enough to tell their top officials to stop taking any public flights, but not enough to start, you know, beefing up any security at local airports or anything like that.
I think that the one thing that will come out of these hearings that will be sort of registerable with just about everybody is that, as Gorelick has said, there was some kind of major, extraordinary intelligence spike saying, you know, during the summer of 2001, saying, these people are out to get us. You know, they're going to get us overseas, or they're going to get us here. They've got something planned that they're going to do to us. And that spike stayed in those daily brief reports, you know, for week after week after week. And I think people are going to be a little freaked out when they realize that nothing was done about that. I mean, and you know what? I mean, maybe a different president wouldn't have done any better with it. Who knows? But I do think that as that gets out, it does kind of fly in the face of the way the Bush administration has always marketed itself as the tough guys, the guys who could get tough, the guys who could, you know, who could do scorched earth and take out the bad guys before they got to us. And I don't think that's who they are, really. I think they're just, you know, they're like everybody else, basically.
I just wanted a quick note for the gentleman who said that, you know, Bill Clinton never did anything against terrorism. It's also more recently a matter of public record that Bill Clinton kept a naval task force station in the Persian Gulf on high alert for the express purpose of striking out against Osama bin Laden the moment any actionable intelligence came
out. That's right. They had guys in subs off the coast of Pakistan with itchy trigger fingers ready to go if they found them.
Tonight, a couple of showers. Tomorrow, occasional showers near 50. 58 now. More traffic and weather together coming up in 10 minutes on WTIC News Talk 1080.
There's a new sound downtown. He's got some edge, some soul. It's the Rhythm Room at Pastis, offering live music every Friday and Saturday night. The Rhythm Room at Pastis is located on Ann Street in downtown Hartford. Whether you're stopping in for dinner or just looking for a place to hang out, Pastis offers something unique with contemporary jazz every Friday and Saturday night. If you like the blues with a good backbeat, jazz with some juice, then the Rhythm Room is your kind of place. It's casual and comfortable and a great night out. Have some delicious food, a drink at the bar, or just kick back, relax, enjoy. The Rhythm Room at Pastis, 201 and 3, downtown Hartford. Why do the same old thing again this weekend? There's some great music happening every Friday and Saturday night at a very hip place. The Rhythm Room at Pastis. So, what are your plans for this weekend?
This is Connecticut.
Well, they're just wrapping up quarterfinal action in the September 11th commission, and it's, so far it's a Richard Clark over Slade Gorton. He'll advance to the next round. And Vanderbilt, trying anything they can do to get a leg up, has sent a case of corn dogs to Jim Calhoun. It's time for Sports à Trois, the very French sports discussion segment. And Mr. Arnold Dean, yourself, Bruce Stevens, and myself, Louis Gascon de la Mer.
It's funny, when you watch the game, you're thinking life and death, and all of a sudden...
The 9/11 hearings are over now for the day, and now they're in the locker room, and a couple of the commissioners are giving hearings.
There's a post-game chat.
They have towels around their waist.
Yeah.
Carol Bassett's got an interesting piece in The Advocate, basically sort of saying that, and it is sort of true that all this Roland stuff is just, it's so vast. It's like the life of fish, according to Angela Dias on this morning's Roy and Debbie show. She said, saying that the life of fish is almost just inconceivably vast.
Fish as in the group or fish?
No, fish in general. There's so many different kinds of fish, and you just can't...
Oh, I see.
You can't take it all in. I think she has a good point. But the Roland situation is very similar to fish. You know, you can't even think about it all. But her point is that, you know, there's freebies, and there's cigars, and there's champagne, and there's work on the cottage, and there's all this kind of stuff. But there's also just a lot of stuff that just translates to flat out cash. You know, there are three major deals. One of them is the condo, the much discussed condo, where there was clearly a substantial amount of money passed through to Roland to create an opportunity for him to make a profit on a condo where he would have been taking a loss. And then, if we were to believe the latest testimony, Roland then squeezed Mr. Matthews for more money, an additional $5,000 for his crappy furniture. There's also the land deal, which is, that's the one, the Naugatuck Prospect Line 1. This is, he partnered with several people who were doing business with the state. He put in $7,200. 5 years later, he pulled out a profit of $52,800. And then there's...
Not too shabby.
Yeah. And then there's the thing that the Current reported on where he made about $26,000 maybe on stock in companies that were run by Otterino or somebody having to do with that whole Otterino G. Fox thing. So there are like a few things where they're just sort of flat out cash. And I mean, one of the interesting things for the feds and for the Select Committee on Inquiry to pursue is, you know, what happened to that money? Where did all that go? Because that's actual money. You know, that's
Curry was kind of ahead of his time here,
yeah,
wasn't he?
What did you do with all the money?
Yeah.
So anyway, just is an article worth reading? She makes that point anyway. It's like, you know, what did he need that money for, and where did it go?
All right, we have to do this a little bit on the quick side. Here's Lee and Akira. Lee.
Hey, good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hi.
Just a few quick points. The reason I think George Bush should be reelected is he lowered our taxes. And the reason I would vote for the Democrat guy is because he called George Bush a crook, but he didn't backpedal on it. And that shows me a little backbone. Do you guys agree?
Right. Well, if that's all that matters to you, and I mean, if in fact, I don't know, you must make a lot of money to see any substantial gain in all of that, but go ahead. It's your right. Have you ever actually seen SpongeBob SquarePants?
A little bit.
I never have. But now I'm getting interested in the movie. There's a movie version coming out. And Scarlett Johansson is voicing one of the roles. She plays Mindy, the daughter of Neptune. Jeffrey Tambor will voice Neptune. Alec Baldwin is voicing Dennis, the ruthless kitten, who comes to keep SpongeBob from the king.
Yeah. Okay.
Pretty good cast.
Well, it is, but...
Yeah. Should we go, John has a question, I think.
All righty. John, hi.
For a riddle.
How are you?
For a conundrum.
Gentlemen, I just wondered, somebody seemed to have turned the light on and critters have scattered in all directions. And even with these hearings, I saw just a little bit of it. That's beside the point. That'll be history. But, Colin, you often mention Slate Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not familiar with it.
Well, it's because you can only get it online. Slate Magazine is www.slate.com. It's a magazine that was started by Microsoft, basically. It attempted to start a first really good, valid online magazine. And the story of this magazine has been kind of remarkable. Michael Kinsley was the original editor of it, although eventually because of his Parkinson's disease, he kind of stepped down. I think Jacob Weisberg is editing it now. But the place is, it's become kind of like this AAA team for the New York Times and Time Magazine and a lot of other big publications. Writers start out on Slate, work there for about a year or two, and boom, the next thing you know, they're up in the big leagues.
Right.
But it's, you know, just in terms of very, I mean, look, we're in the talk show business, and so I'm always looking for pretty fast analysis of something that's going on, and nothing is ever really quite fast enough. I mean, it's, I guess, our job to be faster than anybody, but because Slate's online, they tend to get pieces up there. Like today, you know, there's a pretty good Will Saladin piece talking about the Bush response to Richard Clark, and there's a pretty good piece by a guy they have named Fred Kaplan, who knows Richard Clark reasonably well and just talks about, although I guess they're not speaking to one another, but why he thinks Richard Clark is credible. So, you know, I mean, for us, it's a way to get information and analysis really, really fast. But they're also good. I mean, they're good people, and they're smart.
Well, the other thing is you can't wait for the weekly magazine because they miss their deadline or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we can't wait more than 20 minutes, you know. I mean, so the faster, the better. We run out of caffeine here.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
So just to sort of cover the other important, the big highlights, you and I are doing this Queer Eye for the Straight Guy kind of thing where we're going to be May 6th at the Pond House as a benefit for the Connecticut AIDS Residents Coalition. Jim Shea, Eddie Perez, and you and I will undergo fashion and cosmetic makeovers. Much of it performed on us by homosexuals. But not all of it. And what else? Oh, I'm going to be at the Canton Library tonight, 7:30, talking about myself. Be my topic.
There's a shock.
Myself. And that's about it. I don't know what else. What else? What's on your mind right now?
What else?
Oh, well, you know, I wanted to quickly mention this because this is I we're not supposed to talk about other radio stations and other radio programs, but I'm going to anyway. Bob Edwards, who's done such a spectacular job on Morning Edition on NPR, is being ousted because they want to go after a younger demographic, and Edwards is like 56 years old or something like that. There will be a rebellion. Listen to this, you swinish, bloated NPR chieftains. You're in for it now. I predict a massive nationwide rebellion of public radio listeners. They are not going to let Bob Edwards go easily, and they're not going to let him get pushed out so that you can bring in some, you know, Ira Glass kind of little chirpy twerp to take his place. That's just not going to wash.
Chirpy twerp?
I really, you know, that's what they're going to do. They're going to try to get somebody who sounds a little bit younger and hipper and edgier. People don't want that in the morning. They want Bob Edwards, and really, it's going to, you know, would be like... You know, it's like people like Ray Dunaway in the morning.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
The kind of
well,
they like
well, they should.
They like to hear in the morning.
As well, they should.
You know, we don't want to hear like Mikey C or something.
We're not going to get into that.
I don't want to hear Mikey C at any time. That wasn't a good example. All right, it's like replacing Ray Dunaway with like Kara Sundlin or something. You know, there's nothing wrong with Kara Sundlin. I think she's an elf. But, I mean, people want to hear Ray Dunaway. They want to hear an avuncular
voice of reason.
Yeah. And Bob Edwards is kind of that for NPR. And there's... The guy's a franchise player for public radio. They're so stupid to get rid of him. All right. That's it, my piece. You know what? That's what you want of them. You don't want to listen to somebody like me in the morning, do you? I mean, people can barely stand to listen to me at this time of day when they can legitimately start drinking during the show. They can still barely stand. You know. Even that's not enough, the idea that they can have cocktails while they're listening.
I'd like to thank our producer, Bobby Sherwood.